You're listening to Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Okay, ready for an ooh alert. It is a fungus called coffee rust, and it's attacking coffee plants across Mexico and Central America. It has already caused more than $1 billion in crop losses and cost the jobs of many thousands of workers. Two University of Michigan professors have been studying coffee in Mexico for nearly 20 years. They are John Vandermeer. He's a professor of ecology and evolutionary biology. His research partner is Yvette Perfecto. She's an ecologist and professor in the School of Natural Resources and Environment. Cindy spoke with them about how coffee rust spreads and how we can best put an end to it.
Let's start with, John, what is coffee rust?
Coffee rust is a fungal disease that attacks coffee. It's been known for quite some time in Asia. It was a devastating disease in the late 19th century in Asia. That's, as a matter of fact, one of the reasons coffee became so abundant in Central America and Mexico and Brazil also, because the disease was so decimating in Asia that they had to stop coffee production entirely. So when coffee came to the Americas, rust did not come with it. But then in the late 70s, early 80s, why it was detected in the Americas, and everybody became very, very upset, very worried about it. However, the late 70s, early 80s, and until about 2012, it was persistent in the area, but never became a real big problem. The curious thing about the disease is that 2011, 2012, that was the year that suddenly it burst on the scene and became absolutely epidemic through all coffee production in all of Mexico and Central America and Northern South America also.
So it was on a low simmer for a number of decades, and then kaboom.
Why is that?
Well, that's one of the things that we're trying to understand. And we think that there are several factors that might have contributed to that. Among them is the deforestation that's been going on at the landscape level throughout the region, because the rust is a disease that gets spread by wind. And so the more wind you have in the area, the more it gets into the coffee plants. And so with deforestation, you eliminate a lot of the barriers, potential barriers for the dispersal of the disease. That's one of the potential factors that have led to this, but also application of fungicides, because one of the things that we have discovered is that there are potentially a lot of mycoparasites, which are other fungi that can eat the rust.
So they're an enemy of the rust.
Yes, they are an enemy.
Which means they're the good guys.
Yeah. And if you apply fungicides that are general fungicides that kill all the fungi, they will also kill the beneficial fungi.
So what is your research drilling down and looking at?
As Yvette just said, we're trying to look at the mechanisms whereby this thing has suddenly come on the scene. And we have this mycoparasitic fungus, the fungus that eats the fungus, and we've discovered there that there's a small fly whose larva eats the spores of the fungus also. And so we have these two potential controlling agents there, which we feel have kept the disease under control for many, many, many years, but because, as Yvette says, because of deforestation and also because of the elimination of shade in coffee. Coffee is normally grown in shade, but since the 80s, where there's been a tendency to eliminate shade trees in coffee plantations, which, again, encourages the dispersal of the rust through wind dispersal.
Because there's two main ways of growing coffee, right? Sun and shade. And
when
we saw the ads back in the 80s, the Colombian coffee makers had of Juan Valdez, and that's the sun version.
Yeah.
What are the pluses of that approach?
The main reason why people do coffee monoculture, sun coffee, is to increase yields. New varieties of coffee that can be grown without any shade trees were developed in 50s and 60s, and those can resist, have a higher resistance of changes in temperature and changes in humidity and things like that. They're hardier because they are exposed to the sun for more periods, then they produce more. But the problem is that you need to have like a technological package with the sun coffee, because they produce more as long as you apply fertilizers, as long as you apply herbicides, because if you eliminate the shade, you have then all of a sudden you have a lot of sun hitting this ground, and that basically encouraged the weeds to grow. So you have more weeds, you potentially have more pest because it's a monoculture. That leads to an increase in the use of pesticide, including herbicides and fungicides, and also fertilizers.
It's very much, it sounds like a catch-22, the way this is working. But and you're doing your research at a farm in Mexico that does shade growing. How does that work, and what are the pluses?
The pluses of shade-grown coffee is most of the time the shade trees are actually legume trees, so they provide nitrogen to the soil. So like Yvette says, you don't have to use artificial fertilizer, and they contain all sorts of natural enemies of the various kinds of pests that are trying to attack coffee. For example, what we found in Mexico in our 20 years there, we found over 30 different species of insects that actually eat coffee, but none of them are actually pests. And the reason they're not pests is because they're under control of all the various natural enemies that exist in the shaded coffee system. Once you eliminate that shade, well, you're on the road towards creating new pests that are going to attack the coffee, which then are going to require you to spray insecticides and fungicides and things like that.
It seems like just a classic lesson in the importance of biodiversity.
Oh, definitely. Definitely, because in this plantation, like John was mentioning, the organic shaded plantation that we have been working on for so many years, there's a very high diversity of organisms. And that includes herbivores, but it also includes the natural enemies of those herbivores. And so we have been studying ants, for example, spiders that are natural enemies. Basically, they are predators of other insects, and how they can help control, maintain the coffee without a lot of pests.
How much shade coffee growing is going on? Has the push to produce more, has that led to way more sun farming than shade farming?
Well, there's a kind of an ebb and flow here. I mean, people get enthusiastic about sun coffee, and so they move towards sun coffee, but then it doesn't work so well, so they go back to shade coffee. So there's a little bit of give and take there. On the other hand, once you sort of commit yourself to sun coffee, you're sort of stuck. And that's one of the problems that some farmers feel. They committed themselves because, like Yvette says, they thought they were going to get bigger yields, which, by the way, didn't necessarily turn out all that well. But they committed themselves to sun coffee. Now they're kind of stuck with it. To go from sun coffee to shade coffee is not all that easy. It's possible, but it's not all that easy. Similarly, once you have a farm that's sort of in balance with nature, that's been there for quite a while, where you have a forest-like cover over the coffee, you have all that biodiversity, you have the system that's operating in a kind of a equilibrium fashion.
Humming right along.
Yeah, humming right along, you might say. That's true. And so once you start eliminating the shade, why then you see the problems start emerging.
How concerned, Yvette, are the coffee farmers about keeping an eye on this great spike in coffee rust?
Very concerned. Actually, not just coffee farmers, but the governments as well, because coffee is such an important crop in Latin America. Mm-hmm. It's one of the most important export crops.
How much is at stake money-wise and job-wise?
Well, I'm not sure money-wise, but about 25 million farmers, small-scale farmers, depend on coffee. And especially the small-scale farmers that are living day-to-day, basically, they can't afford to lose money in their crops. And so when the coffee rust hit Mexico, we're more familiar with what's going on in Mexico, but this happened throughout Latin America. When the coffee rust reached such high levels, some of the farmers lost their entire production. There were figures of about 40% of the crop yield being lost due to the coffee rust. If you're a small-scale farmer and you lose most of your crop, basically you cannot survive. And so what some of them have done is sell their farm or start growing something else. It has been a crisis. In Mexico, some farmers have abandoned their crops and basically tried to find jobs someplace else and in some cases moved to the United States.
John, what do you hope will come from your research, particularly in the short range as you try to tamp down this great spike in this fungus?
Well, first of all, I have to be honest, and I'm not sure anybody really understands the fungus all that well. And so our first result, I'm hoping, is that we'll have a better scientific understanding of exactly how the fungus operates so that we can make predictions about what's going to happen in the future. But if I were to make sort of recommendations at the present time based on what we already know, I don't have a lot to say to individual farmers, and that's really very frustrating because farmers really want answers to questions. So when a farmer asks me, what can I do about the coffee rust, about the best thing I can say to him is talk to your neighbors about what they're doing, because it's a regional problem and has to have a regional solution. So farmers as a whole, they have to get on board with reforestation. They have to change their pasture systems, their cattle systems, to silvopastoral systems, putting trees in the pastures. They have to change their coffee systems to shade coffee systems. But it's something that has to happen at a landscape level. It needs planning. An individual farmer is kind of stuck without being able to do much on his or her own.
I know that you take students down to this farm, and you've been doing so for quite a few years. And what are your hopes for these young people that you're working with and that you're teaching?
All the students that come with us, they usually come to do a thesis, to do some research. And they get, you know, because we have accumulated so much information in this particular area, they build upon what other students have done in the past, and they continue, you know, developing these different research projects. So one of the aims is that they will have a very good experience in terms of the research and a collaborative experience as well, because they share what they're doing with the other students. We spend the whole summer there, and they present their work. They consult with us and with each other. So they learn a lot from each other. But also, I think it's a really good experience for them in terms of experiencing a different culture, being in a different country, seeing what it takes to be a farmer, to be able to produce, and, you know, what the knowledge that is behind mm-hmm. producing coffee. Farmers need to know a lot about their system. They get to talk to people there about how they're producing coffee. They get to talk to the owners of the coffee farms, to the workers. And they go to town, have a good time in the town as well, and get to practice their Spanish, get to become friends with people in Latin America. And sometimes those friendships last for many, many years. They go back and visit them, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a cultural as well as an academic experience for them.
That you're hoping they're going to take out into their careers and into their universities as they move on and onward, right?
Let me add to that, too. I mean, it would be remiss not to acknowledge that the students have a huge impact into our own intellectual development and all the stuff that we've done in coffee, and I think is reflected in the stories that have come out at the University of Michigan recently. I mean, the stuff that we've done is done with the students. The students are the ones who provide much of the intellectual input, much of the creativity, much of what we feel we've made advancements in is due to the students themselves.
If coffee rust is not curbed, if it continues to grow, does it threaten the entire coffee crop in Mexico and Central America?
I'm reticent to make any kind of predictions at all.
It's a broad statement, yeah. I understand.
I mean, that's the worry that everyone has, and I can say that thus far it looks pretty bad. I'm hopeful that it's not going to be all that bad, but I just can't be very positive about it at the present time.
And let me add that it happened before when the rust attacked coffee in Southeast Asia.
Yes.
It basically eliminated coffee production from the area. So historically, we have an example of that happening.
And it'll be interesting to see how long it is before American coffee prices reflect in a big way what's happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the economics of coffee at the mm-hmm. international level is kind of complicated, actually.
Yes, very much. And I understand you're a biologist, you're working in the mm-hmm. field and trying to do that. Well, it'll be interesting to follow your work, and we really want to thank you for sharing your experiences with us and your research with us.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
John Vandermeer is with the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology and the program In the Environment at the University of Michigan. And Yvette Perfecto is a professor at the School of Natural Resources.